fascinating new thing you've seen making one a temporary savior. Fascinating new thing, don't betray them by becoming familiar.
I don't know exactly how we should introduce this because we're doing something a little unusual today. would you like to explain the revelation that you had that has led us to this point?
It really is a joyous occasion. The Matrix is 20 years old. 10 Things I Hate About You is also 20 years old. They came out at the same time, 20 years ago, which makes me feel very old. And once I realized, I feel like I should have realized that before, because these are movies that I have watched on end since their release. But somehow I never ever put those pieces together that, like, they came out at the exact same time.
I didn't either.
Probably because we were just too young to actually see them when they came out.
Exactly.
And I didn't see either of them until several years later, because they came out in 1999, making, in theory, 10 Things the last film of the 90s, and The Matrix the first film of the new millennium, frankly, is my thesis. Because it's very weird to watch them back to back and think, yes, this absolutely came out, this was being made at the same time, and, like, arrived in the world at the same time. These are both American films.
Yeah.
Because people feel like counterparts in a lot of ways.
Well, so that is why we decided to do this podcast, dear listeners, because the idea that both of these films were released on March 31st, 1999, kind of blew our minds, that, like, they were being shot at the same time, they were released at the same day. Presumably audience members went to go see, like, both of them in theaters, and they were contemporaneous to each other, with each other, and yet they're very different films. But are they? Like, how are they similar, and how are they different, and how do they represent where we were as a society in 1999 in various ways? Or were they, like, ahead of their time? Yeah, these are the explorations that I think we're going to try and dig into here in the world's unlikeliest compare and contrast scenario.
I feel like both films, I mean, yeah, both films are absolutely, like, super beloved, and they both have had, like, a rash of think pieces since they both have an anniversary this year. But, you know, how many people are in the Venn diagram, right? Like, are the people who obsessively talk about 10 Things and, like, quote it in everyday life, are they also obsessively talking about The Matrix? And, I mean, in my case, that is true.
Yes. It's probably a little bit less true for me because I loved The Matrix when I first saw it, and, like, it should be said that I own both movies on DVD, so therefore I love them enough to own them. However, The Matrix, I have not rewatched a lot since loving it as a teenager, just because it's kind of a heavy movie, and 10 Things is so much more just, like, fun, basically. I'm a simple lady. I just want to be entertained.
That's fair. And even still, I feel like, you know, if 10 Things is the cap to the 90s teen film, it, other than Heathers, is probably one of the heavier ones, right?
True. True. Well, and that was something that I was sort of thinking, because both movies are very iconic and very quotable and very, like, sort of little pinnacles of their genres. And I was trying to think about, like, the torch of, like, teen comedy / teen romantic comedy. And, like, I feel like for 10 Things, the previous torchbearer was maybe Clueless, and the one after it was maybe Mean Girls.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of cultural legacy. The Matrix I had a harder time with, and I rely on your science fiction knowledge, because I have dropped off with science fiction as I have gotten into my adult years. But before The Matrix, what would have been the, what do you think would have been the predecessor? Terminator?
Yeah, Terminator, and one of the pieces that I read recently, for the Matrix celebration of its 20 years on Earth, basically posited that it was the, you know, the it paved the way for superhero films, which rather than like strictly sci-fi movies, which I think is probably true. Cause I mean, watching it, you're like, oh yeah, they're like flying, you know, the action sequences, you know, any idea of powers and like that kind of thing, reality bending. It is sort of a superhero film rather than being what you and I probably would consider a sci-fi film, which is going to be Star Wars or Alien.
Sure. That's a good point.
I mean, you could probably make an argument that Neo is like a Jedi, but the entire, the philosophical bent of those two franchises is, I think, totally different. So, yeah, putting it in like a strict science fiction lineage, I don't think is super accurate. I think it's more of an action film in the mode of The Terminator, which is science fiction because it's about robots and like time travel and shit, but I don't think anybody's out here being like, it's a great sci-fi film, like it's a great action film. The science, maybe not so much.
Sure.
Not sure if it holds up.
Sure.
But at the same time, like, they have the same concern about what it means to be human and the idea that the machines, that robots and AI are the natural enemy of humanity, which I don't entirely agree with, but we can talk about that later.
All right, so put a pin in that. We'll get back to AI. Well, it is interesting, I think, because obviously as someone who doesn't watch as much sci-fi anymore, and a lot of my interest in sci-fi movies is rooted in, like, Joseph Campbell, basically. Like, I'm like, backing in from the humanities, like, hey, guys, can we talk about the hero with a thousand faces? So that's, I think that's more of what I took away from The Matrix, in thinking about, like, you know, obviously the concept of, like, the One, and what does that mean, and how does the narrative of the One in this movie differ from other, like, hero narratives. And it's, I suppose it's worth noting as well, like, you know, yeah, the concept of a hero narrative versus, like, a superhero film. That, yeah, like, it makes sense to put The Matrix in, like, a superhero predecessor category. I never thought of that.
In some, I mean, of course, the flip side to my earlier anti-comparison to Star Wars is that The Matrix, and as I recall, it was sort of mocked for this at the time, and maybe has been since as well, is that it is very concerned with, like, with mythic scope, and it has a lot of references, especially the later films, to mythology specifically. I mean, you meet characters named things like Persephone, and of course, you know, Neo is like, is he Jesus? I don't know. Is, like, he a demigod? You know, what is he?
Yeah.
And so it definitely has that flavor.
Yeah.
That Star Wars, of course, also has.
Yes.
And yeah, I think it's a great hybrid of a lot of different tropes, and that's probably why it felt so strange when it came out originally and blew everyone's minds, because it doesn't feel like one thing or the other, because it has so many tendrils and antecedents, and you can pretty much pick any kind of genre film and say this is where it came from. You can pick noir, which I think most people probably tend to, and you know, you can say after this superheroes boomed and they had a template for making superhero movies, and you can talk about machines and the internet and all of those concerns that come from The Terminator and, well, are continued in the Terminator franchise, which is still happening, much to my chagrin, because they're not good.
Well, it is something, like, as I was watching it, I kept thinking, like, you know, this is very, like, prescient to 1999 because of the internet as this new world and a new, basically there's a new technology to transpose the, like, age old question of, like, reality. And, like, I was reading through the IMDb trivia, so I can't claim any smart points for this, but in it they were saying that, like, oh yes, this is just a modern adaptation of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And I was like, bitch, what? So there was part of me that was,
well, so that's, I hate Plato.
All right, we won't invoke Plato anymore. But the idea being, like, when you were talking about Terminator, so, like, you know, there's a part of me that when I was watching it, I was like, this was huge, and it kicked off so many things and spun out so many new concepts of reality and you know, machines and the internet. But really, it's just there was new technology to be a container for that question that has been asked in various times before us with whatever new technology there was. And, like, even though the Matrix, like, blew our minds and is, like, a cultural touchstone in cinema, it really is just another example of those questions in just a different package. Packaged up in a different way, and in a well-made way. Like, that was another thing. Like, when I was watching it, I was like, damn, the Wachowskis are good. Like, this is a well-spun-out movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's still impressive the way that Jurassic Park is still impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time that I saw it, and I, like, did not know what was happening. And that would have been at the height of, like, being into Star Wars and having that be sort of what I was used to in terms of science fiction, because... you know, the superhero boom hadn't happened yet. We didn't have this glut of flashy action sequences and cool costumes and people flying through the air and CGI and all this. And so looking at it and thinking, okay, he's using the technology that I'm using. Like, this is theoretically possible. Because they did a very canny thing of saying, and having the characters say, this is the year 1999, as you know it. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that is that they don't actually, and the viewer doesn't actually know what year it is in reality, which means that you don't have to do any more work beyond that. And it makes everyone's lives so much easier, because you're still banking on whatever was contemporary at the time. And watching it now, with the internet having moved on significantly in a lot of really obvious and profound ways, for better or worse, like, it still isn't troubling to see Neo be, like, the 1990s version of a hacker.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only do I remember what that was supposed to mean at the time, but, you know, the Matrix itself, you know, it's in some future date that is still future to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels futuristic still.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the technology is now outdated.
Yeah. Yeah, seeing the cell phones and the computers in good old 1999 was like, whew, like, cutting edge, y'all. This was real.
Like, the amount of hardline usage, amount of, like, I mean, could you even find a phone booth now if you needed to?
That, I thought so about screwed. That. It really did exist at that, like, so, like, my dad bought a car once that had both a cassette deck and a navigation system. And I was like, Dad, this is, there was like 1 year, there must have been just like 1 year on the cusp of that where you could get both. And I feel like the Matrix existed in like the 1 year where you could still legitimately say that there were that many phone booths, but where you could also purport that like reality was constructed by the internet. And that like, there's only a brief window of time where both things could possibly be true.
In a way, I feel like that's why it's so great that 10 Things came out at the same time, because it's a perfect sort of, you know, mirror. The two movies set against each other illustrate that perfectly, because in 10 Things, like, it's the same year as 1999 in the Matrix land, but you don't see even proto-cell phones. There's no computer usage.
Yeah.
It's a very analog movie
it
in
really
a lot of
is.
Ways, which isn't a bad thing, but it's very weird.
The only one...
Sure, I mean, even crappy cell phones were around, and you're watching Clueless, and she has her, like, her really, really old computer with its, like, fashion program on it. And so, like, that was a thing, but it just doesn't... It's not a thing inside the world of 10 Things I Hate About You in any way. And so it's like, yeah, these things, you could still be in that particular part of history, even if you're an upper middle class white girl who would have a cell phone, probably, who would have a computer, or you could be Neo and have 15 computers running at the same time and be selling viruses to really sketchy dudes with interesting girlfriends.
Yes. Well, that's like, yeah, that cell phones and computers, the things that we are constantly plugged into nowadays, and like the questions of what it means to be plugged in, are much more prevalent now than then, because they're much more pervasive now than then. And so you could feasibly believe that you could go through the whole movie of 10 Things I Hate About You, and the only computer usage is the guidance counselor writing porn at work on her computer. That's it.
Iconic.
That's the only one. And that's believable. But nowadays, like, it would probably be noticeable. And it reminds me a little bit of, like, on Buffy. Like, Buffy lived through that transition of cell phones not being common to being common. And by the time you get to, like, season 7, you're like, well, technically they could call each other now to, like, keep them more informed. And it's interesting watching storytelling devices and tropes change, because communication can be instantly traded now and accessed if you have a cell phone, because you can call someone and tell them they're in danger. You can Google something to figure out a way out of danger. Like, there are so many ways that, like, writers have to struggle with, like, stakes and obstacles now, because technology exists and you can't ignore it.
Yeah, I feel like we talked about this recently. The idea that particularly people who write young adult fiction might be inclined to set it at a time prior to immediate access to info and immediate transmission of, you know, conversations and information. And so, yeah, after a point, you have to decide if you want to write a period piece or if you want to make something like Gossip Girl, where technology is absolutely at the behest of the plot.
It's like a character.
And nobody uses it otherwise. Or you can make something like The Matrix, in which the whole hinge is, this is a new technology, and what does it mean for humanity?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you can do that even without making a science fiction product.
Hmm. Interesting.
So you can, you know, write a contemporary story that uses the current technology that we have in interesting ways that doesn't, you know, and then not have to sacrifice character development or tension necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like, I think if you choose to ignore technology because you don't want to write your way out of the corner of the stakes and obstacles you're trying to set up, then, like, it's a little bit lazy. Like, yeah, it sucks that you have to come up with new solutions to, like, propel your story forward when, like, a character can just call someone or look something up. And I feel like there are examples, I'm sure, on movies and television where, like, there's a really lazy cop-out where, like, they don't have signal or they dropped their phone or something like that, where it's just like, no, come up with a way around it. Like, I know it's not easy, but, like, theoretically, you could come up with something brilliant.
I mean, obviously, I don't know that much about the making of 10 Things I Hate About You, oddly. Mainly because the New York Times oral history was behind a paywall.
Rude.
So I didn't read it. Although I'm sure it's pretty good.
Kat Stafford would not be on board with that.
But, I mean, it probably, I wouldn't be surprised if it just didn't occur to them to use any of the extant emerging technology, because the plot doesn't demand it.
It may have been developed, because I know the two women who wrote it, I don't remember if it was that script or Legally Blonde. I think it was 10 Things I Hate About You. They were not in the same city when they wrote it, and email wasn't a thing yet. And so they sent drafts back and forth to each other by FedEx. So it may have been written even before, like, a few years before when it was released. So, like, there really wasn't as much.
Because it does, I mean, it feels very old school, I guess. Mm. You know, it feels much more like a 90s film than a millennial film.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. I guess that would make it part of, like, the old guard, which is a really good way to go out, frankly, because it's a great movie.
Yes. It is interesting. Well, and then I just started thinking about, like, Mean Girls, like, 5 years later. Like, how much did technology advance in Mean Girls? And, like, they were... was it that much? Like, I can't think of any internet scenes or cell phone scenes.
Yeah,
like,
they weren't cyberbullying each other. It was all very analog, old school bullying.
Yes. Yeah, burn, well, like, four-way calling, yeah, print material, like using the landline.
There was no nasty MySpace wall post. It was all, like, in print, in a book.
Yeah, prank calling. Although they did address, like, caller ID, at least, in that one, when she calls Taylor, what's-her-face's mom, when she's pretending to be from Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Like, she at least does say, like, there's no caller ID if you connect from the operator. Can you even connect from the operator anymore? Like, is that even a thing anymore?
I have no concept. This is what I learned when I did phone reference for a public library, and every now and then I would get a patron who was like, well, the operator couldn't help me with this. And I'm like, I don't know what you mean, but I will try.
Yeah, that's a mystery. I have no idea what that really is anymore. It is interesting also, like, to compare the two for a moment. The idea that, you know, the hero of a thousand faces put into, you know, the internet and technology and, like, the sci-fi norms of the day or the technology norms of the day. I mean, you could argue that 10 Things I Hate About You did something similar in that it's taking Shakespeare. It's taking a very old concept, an old story, and then updating it with these social norms of the day or the comedy norms and the teenager norms of the day. Which, was that the first one to do that? And were there others than Oh, and She's the Man? Is that the trilogy of Shakespeare teens?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Clueless is not Shakespeare, obviously. It's Austen, but it came out first.
I think you could count that.
But as far as Shakespeare specifically, type. Yeah. And then, I mean, She's the Man is a straight-up comedy. I would say that 10 Things is a slightly more serious film, even though I love She's the Man. And Oh is actually really disturbing.
I was about to say, Oh is definitely a drama. She's the Man is definitely a comedy. Because there's also just, like pratfalls. It's a very broad comedy.
Yeah, I like that about the two movies, that they feel modern for their time, obviously, but they're both, one is a myth story and one is Shakespeare.
Mm.
Like, these are the two great films of 1999, and, you know, neither of them is new per se, although they're both, it's funny, like, obviously The Matrix was very, very new, and 10 Things... I mean, as somebody who would have liked to have been a riot girl, like, it's set in Seattle. It's very much about, like, you know, girl power and the club skunk scene, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like the 90s in a way that even the soundtrack of The Matrix is like, oh, this is firmly, like, this is almost 2000.
Yes.
And, you know, anything that happens in a cusp year, you know, a record that comes out in 1980 is going to sound more like 70s rock music than 80s rock music, or what 80s would become. So it makes sense. But it's joyous to me to see those as, like, the two, like, the Janus head of the 90s, basically, where you're stepping through the doorway and the Matrix is waiting for you. And what's behind you is Patrick Verona.
I know. All of his little freckle face close-ups and his little sweet baby face. I was so endeared. He's so good. He's so good in that movie.
He's really funny. I read something recently that was about, like, the casting of him and that character. And that basically the casting director talked to him for, like, 5 minutes and was like, done.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Heath Ledger's like, it wasn't very long. Like, did I bomb it? Like, no, you didn't. The exact opposite, actually.
He's so good. And his character is, like, his character is hard. I don't know. You could argue that a fair few of the characters in that movie are kind of hard to dimensionalize. because I feel like they sort of extend a little bit beyond their tropes. Like, they are not just the, like, archetype that they're sort of meant to serve within the narrative, which is something that makes the movie good. And, like, I will be Team Bianca, like, forever and always. I love her.
Bianca's hysterical, and she's also very smart.
I love her so much. I love that, like, I love that she is not really unlike her sister. She just hasn't gotten a chance to, like, know herself yet. That because her dad is so controlling, that, like, she thinks she wants these things. And then as soon as she experiences them, she realizes, like, this is the worst. And, like, I didn't realize in Bogie Lowenstein's party, like, that's when that is cemented, when she goes to that party and then has, like, a lot of distaste for Gabrielle Union. I forget what her name is. Chastity?
Yeah. Maybe not. God, that's such a, that is, I feel like I knew a girl named Chastity in middle school.
Oh, no.
So, it's exactly the right time.
Exactly. but she has, like, a distaste for her, and she has, she grows to really dislike Joey Donner very quickly. And my favorite cut of the movie, which is the cut to him putting the beer can on top of the stack of empty beer cans with the, like, song in the background, you know the song, and he's modeling the, like, swimsuit versus underwear shots, and, like, she's just like, uh-huh, and, like, she realizes that he is completely an idiot. And then not 10 seconds later, she also sees her sister get drunk and dance on a table, and is, like, a little judgy for it. Is, like, a little, like, disappointed by it. And, like, those are the cementing moments where she, like, decides, like, who she is and who she is not. And I love her for it.
It's like exposure therapy.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not the right word.
Well.
I mean, you know, the idea that, like, you don't know what you want until you know what you don't want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Team Bianca forever. But like, I feel like, going back to Heath Ledger, like, the character of Patrick, like, I feel like it could be very easy to exaggerate that, or to make that, like, not likable, or to, like, really make him kind of a stereotype, because he's meant to appear as if he's a bad boy, quote unquote. But one thing that I really love about his character is the conversation he has with Cameron. The fact that he like kind of befriends Cameron and his weird little AV nerd friend and like has encouraging words for him and sort of says like, I forget, it's the conversation he has actually with Cameron, I think, after Bogie Lowenstein's party.
When he tells him that it's okay to want things?
Yeah, yes. Like,
give me your pep talk, Patrick Verona, because I need it too, still.
Yes, that scene is, like, so darling, and I love that that's just, like, a little message that they shoehorned in there of, like, you're worth it, and you are, like, valid for doing this and for wanting this. And, you know, obviously, you have to tiptoe right up and not pass the line of just, like, just keep trying, like, keep wearing her down. Like, but the idea that the message is not couched in terms of, like, go get the girl. It's couched in terms of, like, you're a good person and you should, like, and you deserve good things. And that's, like, I love that so much. And I appreciate that so much. That comes from the mouth of Patrick, of all people.
He's very wise.
He is wise for doing a really dumb thing in the movie.
Yeah, whenever I watch 10 Things, which is, you know, fairly frequently,
sure.
I always have to confront, of course, the fact that the driving force of the film, and this is Shakespeare's fault, not the film's fault, is that somebody is trying to fuck with someone else's life, like, and
yeah.
They may not ever know that, because when you see Cameron at after the prom scene, when he and Bianca are going to go sailing, I think that's the first time he actually talks to Kat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're like, oh, do you want to come with? And she's like, no, not really. And the whole time you're thinking, man, you really screwed this girl's up, like, life up in order to get with her sister, which is pretty indefensible.
Yeah.
And then you don't even ever actually, like, get closure on that because, I mean, he doesn't ever apologize. Because,
yeah.
Like, why would you admit that this was your master plan was to, you know, drastically change the course of someone's personal life over a matter of weeks.
Yes. You know, this is a very good point.
And so, I mean, obviously, you know, there's not really a good way to spin that, but in the context of The Matrix, I think it's interesting because the whole idea of The Matrix is that, you know, your life is not yours. Someone is pulling the strings. You need to have your eyes opened, possibly by force. And then things will be not necessarily better, but at least you know, won't be living inside this lie.
Yeah.
I'm not willing to apply that entirely to 10 Things because I love it too much. And certainly by the end of the film, you know, Kat seems happy with her situation and her choices. And, you know, obviously Patrick is pretty irresistible. And so there's no reason to say, oh, if somebody had told her what was happening in a different way than the way that she was told, that she would have made different choices necessarily.
Yeah.
But, I mean, given I feel like the moral of the 90s girl story is that, like, you can have it all. You can go to Sarah Lawrence, and you can also have a really hot dude who's, like, excited that you're going to Sarah Lawrence, and buys you guitars.
Yeah.
And maybe even form a band.
Yeah,
like that was what girl power meant at the time.
Yes,
and at some point it morphed into, you know, lean in, I guess, in our age.
Yeah,
and then like the flip side of 90s moralizing really naturally did segue into like the Matrix's concerns, I feel like, and our current concerns of how much does technology control my life. Should I talk to Alexa, or will, you know, that eventually really backfire on me?
Alexa will turn on you.
Can I be trendy outside of the scope of Neo, like, and so forth?
Well, and that's something I think I definitely, when I watched both films, I mean, both Kat Stratford and Trinity jump off the screen as, like, girl power ladies of 1999.
You know, you meet Trinity first in,
yes,
Matrix.
Yes.
The entire opening sequence is devoted to her. You don't,
yes,
even meet Neo until like 15 minutes in.
Exactly. And I love also, so that's the thing. So the kind of the concept of having it all, that for women characters, there was a light of empowerment and of saying like, she is the main character. She is in control of her decisions. She's not there just to be an accessory or a love interest. Like, those things had finally started coming to pass, and so we do get Kat Stratford, who, like, verbally abuses Joey Donner at every chance she gets, and, like, it feels totally earned.
And her dad likes that about her.
Yes.
That's, like, probably been my like, number one favorite thing about the film, is that he genuinely likes, like, both of his daughters.
Yeah.
He's, like, super overprotective, sure, and maybe misguided in his attempts to, you know, to shape their lives, but he is, you know, approving of the idea that maybe someday, at some point this afternoon, Kat will maim someone.
Yeah.
And she might tell him about it, or like when Bianca punches Joey at the prom, and then he says that he's impressed. You know, he's like a good film dad.
Yes.
for that, those types of characters.
Yes. Yeah, and so, yeah, so we get this idea that, like, the women of 10 Things are allowed to be that, are allowed to be a little bit more empowered and allowed to be spunky in a way that's not through the male lens per se, but that is still like appreciated and valued by the men around them, I
guess. Because Patrick likes it too.
Exactly.
When Kat like maims Joey's car.
Oh my god, it's so good.
He's like laughing the whole time. Or even in the bookstore after they've had a fight and Kat like insults him and shoves the feminine mystique at him, he smiles.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
I love it so much. You can tell this movie was made by women. but it is also a love story, and it is also women, both of the women in the movie, like you said, like, it's hard to ignore that both of them are subject to the machinations of horny dudes around them, or like Patrick's motivation is money, like, you know, it's hard to ignore that. And so it is sort of on the precipice, or like sort of both of those things sort of warring. And I think you could say the same thing about The Matrix. because, like, yes, Trinity is introduced first, and Trinity is her own character. She gives that speech in the end where she says she's going with Neo because Morpheus means more to her than he does to him. And, like, she, I don't know, she mouths off at him, and it's fantastic. And she also is, like, kind of a mentor. Like, she gets to know more than him, and she gets to be more skilled than him, at least insofar as, you know, she's had more experience, and, you know, she's not the one, but, like, whatever. But then at the same time, her prophecy, the thing that the Oracle told her, is that she's gonna fall in love with the one. And it's like, really? Is that what the Oracle told her? Like, that's it. Like, that, so there's this, like, this push and pull of, like, Trinity's amazing. And, like, you know, and it's not to say that you can't have, like, an empowered, amazing female character in, like, a story arc that doesn't have something to do with romance. But at the same time, it is just sort of like, he gets to be the one and she gets to fall in love with the one. Like, okay.
I feel like the 90s girl power mode of 10 things appears in The Matrix at the very beginning when Neo meets Trinity, and he doesn't say that he thought she was a guy until she prompts him to, and then she says, of course, most guys do. Mm. And, like, because that's the story of girl power in the internet age. Because you can be anonymous online. You can pretend to be a man when you're a woman, or you can use a gender-neutral name like Trinity, and men will assume that you're a man because you're competent or better at something than them.
Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah.
And so that's, and in hindsight, like, I don't know. Admittedly, I've watched the second and third films much less than the first one.
I've never even seen them.
For lots of reasons. But I don't recall that with all the talk of identity and, you know, becoming who you're meant to be and using technology to your advantage and transhumanism in a lot of literal ways, I don't remember that the franchise ever really grapples with this. Maybe because when they were being made, the internet was still super nascent, and it hadn't become what it has become by now, especially in terms of social media.
Yeah.
But in watching it now, like, that always sticks out to me in a huge way. The idea that, and actually, Ready Player One also failed massively on this front by having the Artemis character, or not the Artemis character, the H character. You are supposed to assume the entire time is a boy who's talking to the main character and working with the main character. And then the big reveal is that he's a girl, a black girl, who, as I recall, is also gay. So it's sort of a checklist. And you could do a lot of things with that. You know, why would this character choose to appear male online?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the story doesn't ever do that because it's not that kind of story. And I'm not sure that The Matrix does do those things to the extent that we might want them to.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes down to, I remember reading something that came out, I feel like not long after Guardians of the Galaxy, that kind of put forth the idea that there is a trend in a lot of hero movies in sort of a post-girl power world where women are allowed to be the most competent in the universe, but they are not the chosen one. They are the chosen one's major helper. And, like, so kind of like the Hermione or like Gamora, where the chosen male is, like, maybe not altogether equipped, but he's still chosen. And there is a female who is passionate and has, like, a motivation or it already is a part of the cause. And you could even put this back in Star Wars, honestly, with Leia and with Luke, that, like, there's a doofy dude and then who is chosen, but then the, like, motivated, hardworking, competent, capable, no-nonsense female who's, like, saddled with this chosen one who has to save his skin at every turn, but he's still the chosen one.
Yeah, because you can be incompetent or a neophyte or whatever it is, as long as you have fate on your side.
Yes.
And, I mean, I love Neo. But you certainly can't say he's the most interesting character in the movie.
No.
Which is true for most chosen ones, to be fair. Like,
yeah.
I will say I do love Luke Skywalker, and I think he is very interesting.
Yes.
But I don't always love Harry Potter. And, I mean, you know, the obvious hook for any film like this, or media property like this, is that you have to have someone who is new as the entry point.
Yes.
You can't just, you can't have Trinity be the main character because she already knows everything.
Yes.
And so there's no way of, you know, introducing these things. And the most obvious vehicle for character development is somebody who's brand new, becoming what they were born to be.
Yeah.
But the whole point of The Matrix is that you don't have to be born to be anything, right? You can be anything because reality isn't real. And because Neo has this duo persona, and which of them is more real? I mean, if you want, honestly, we can admit this. This is a safe space. Yeah, I would probably be Cypher. I don't want to wake up. Thanks. Sorry, I have enough going on.
Yeah. I don't know. They could have definitely made him more sympathetic. Like he's pretty. He looks like a quote-unquote rat. Like he looks, or like a fink, or like whatever the, like,
he's a villain.
Yeah, like you can tell. And I feel like they could have definitely gotten away with making it a lot more gray area, because honestly, yeah, like who in their right mind wouldn't just prefer to enjoy steak and not eat gruel and know that humanity is screwed? Like, it's a compelling argument, frankly. One thing that I will say that I did appreciate about The Matrix in terms of what the main character knows, as you know, as the world is being revealed to them, which is always the, you know, the hero with a thousand faces is, you know, somebody who has no idea of the world beyond their, you know, small life, is then introduced to it by like a mentor character. They refuse the call, and then the call punches them in the face, and then they have to accept their destiny. One thing that I did like, although even though another thing I read on the IMDb trivia page is that, like, I don't, some like inordinate percentage of Neo's dialogue is like questions. Like it's just him asking questions for at least the first half of the movie, which, like, fine, this is a concept film and there needs to be exposition and he is the character to do that. But one thing I did appreciate is that he already had an inkling of the Matrix. Like he already knew the word, like there was already some suggestion that he had intuited something or experienced something, which I appreciated that he wasn't just coming in out of the blue, or green, I suppose, as it were, and just be like, you say what? Like, he already had a little bit of a foundation on which to build this truth.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I don't recall that the film ever explains that.
Yeah, I don't think
so. So, I mean, am I supposed to assume that it's just that it was a popular conspiracy theory at the time? And since he hung out on the internet, he'd heard about it, which, I mean, is very realistic,
true,
to be fair.
True.
A little chillingly realistic now.
Yeah. Sadly.
But yeah, he's... I think, I don't know, my favorite probably of his and Morpheus's conversations is the first one, where Morpheus is like, we already know you're looking for something. You don't know what you're looking for, but you're on the right track, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. Something else, speaking of Morpheus, something else that I appreciate that was a slight deviation of The Hero with a Thousand Faces is that they didn't kill Morpheus. Like, Morpheus, even though the prophecy was such that, like, it was either Morpheus or Neo, that, like, they didn't actually kill him. And also the fact that Morpheus is Lawrence Fishburne and a black man, like, makes that even, like, a smarter decision, especially now looking back and just going, like, oh, good. Like, that was a wise move.
I'm looking something up really quickly.
No worries.
I wanted to look up when Blade came out, which Blade came out the year before The Matrix.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it's probably a little too much to say that Morpheus belongs to the same, like, trajectory as the character Blade, who is also a really badass black man in a trench coat with really great fight scenes, because I suspect the films were probably written around the same time,
mm-hmm.
in the way that Dark City came out immediately prior, I think, to The Matrix, like maybe in 98. And so after The Matrix came out, everyone was like, oh, it's just a Dark City ripoff. But they would have been being made around the same time. So it's interesting to watch all three of those, I think, and pick out, you know, Blade is a superhero vampire film and a great movie, but very much in, certainly in a 90s vampire mode, and also in more of like a blaxploitation.
I was about to say, that sounds like a lot of genre. Just like genre, genre, genre.
And Dark City is sci-fi, but it's also very noirish.
Ooh.
And sort of in like the German sci-fi film lineage. And then The Matrix is a good sort of middle point between being very sci-fi and very superhero, and also having that visual coding of like underworld, there might be vampires. I bet people who made trench coats made a lot of money that year.
Mm-hmm. And whoever made those sunglasses.
Oh my god, remember how everybody had those fucking sunglasses?
I was trying to think, I was like, did... I feel like that style sunglasses was already a little bit popular when The Matrix came out. But that, like, that style is definitely not popular now. And then I was like, what would it look like now? Like, what, like, trench coats would still be... Would still
yeah, you
be,
can get
would
away with
be,
a
yeah.
lot of the costuming
but the
if
glasses.
You're making The Matrix now, because black is never going to go out of style.
No.
A dramatic coat is never going to go out of style.
No.
But a lot of it is so very much what cyberpunk was at the time.
Yeah.
Very fetishy.
Yeah.
It's funny to compare the two club scenes. I was thinking about this when I was watching 10 Things, because I watched that one second as like a nightcap. Because I didn't want to go to bed thinking really heavy thoughts
Fair.
About the nature of reality.
Yeah.
And whether when I have deja vu and I still say, it's a glitch in the Matrix. They changed something. But yeah, because like Club Skunk is like a very Riot Girl type Seattle club where Kat goes to watch her girl band play angry girl music of the indie rock persuasion. And then Neo goes with his weird mescaline friend to what I assume is supposed to be a fetish club in this non-specific city. And just the look is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in theory, Patrick in his very strange pants could probably have fit in pretty well in the club that Neo goes to, where everyone is wearing latex.
Strange pants.
Every time I see his pants, I'm like, what are those made out of? Like, nail polish? They look like they're just, like, liquid. It's very, very weird looking.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you switch over, and then suddenly everybody is wearing effectively liquid black clothing.
Yeah.
Those were the two halves of the club scene in Ice 99, I'm sure. And then probably ravers somewhere.
Yeah. But... Another thing that jumped out at me about The Matrix is, like, the video game type quality to it. That there's a lot of wish fulfillment, and maybe this is part of its like predecessor of superhero boom. Or I don't know. But there's a lot of like, I think about like nerd fantasies, and it's definitely a nerd fantasy. Which I guess I don't know. I guess you could argue that a lot of really popular nerdy movies are popular because they are nerd fantasies. But The Matrix just really, really seemed like a nerd fantasy that, like, you could... And like, kind of understandably so. Like, would I love to upload jujitsu skills to my brain? Like, yes. Like, please. Like, I would love to have jujitsu skills without actually having to spend the time or effort in learning and training in jujitsu. There's this idea of, like, the power of your mind and that, like, you don't... That you can... achieve anything if you just kind of put your mind to it, which is sort of like going back to what you said earlier, comparing Neo to a Jedi. That's also kind of like what the Force is. Where granted, there's a little more like old school grounded spirituality training, I guess, that goes along with the Force and with the Jedi. But there was a definite sense of like that wish fulfillment of like video games, that you can insert yourself into this constructed world and act out a series of fantasies that could not happen in the real world, including like being able to upload skills to your being and like, you know, being able to, I mean, use all those guns basically. And also a little bit of the, like, there's a lot of violence in that movie. And I feel like they're able to get a little bit away with it by being like, well, it's not real. Like,
yeah, it's interesting because it is hyper violent. It has a ton of fight scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's so little blood that when you actually see the blood, it's like, what is happening?
Yeah.
I'm thinking specifically of...
Trinity shoots somebody point blank.
Yeah, but there's a scene where I can't think of... It might be Neo's initial training scene with Morpheus. He spits blood.
Mm.
Like, he has blood in his mouth.
Yeah.
And you're like, holy shit. Because, like, the whole point is that it's not supposed to be real.
Yeah.
And then the next cut, the blood is gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, so it's not real.
Yeah.
Like, he did that with his mind. Was he bleeding because he suspected he should be bleeding? Because Morpheus is whipping his ass? Was he actually bleeding? Now that the blood is gone, like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's also trippy.
Because there, you know, there's not a lot of, it's not gory. Even when, at the end, when Agent Smith explodes, because Neo has literally gotten inside of him.
Yeah.
And burst him open from the inside out. Like, it's not, I mean, yeah, he literally explodes, but it's not, you know, body parts, obviously, because he's not human.
Honestly.
And so I suspect that that's how they, this was rated R, though, wasn't it?
It was rated R.
I was gonna say, I thought that was how they got away with it, but I think it is actually rated R.
It is. Sci-fi violence in brief language.
I don't actually think that there's much of a case for making it an R-rated film.
Not by today's standards.
Yeah, definitely. Because it is so violent, but because there is a lack of, like, limbs being torn off or, you know, blood spattering the screen or these things that are very normal in Hollywood films. And because it's so stylized, it doesn't even really look like violence sometimes.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
and
like...
It's almost like a dance. Like, again, at the end when Neo has leveled up in his fight... And he's blocking Agent Smith with, like, one arm, and he looks bored.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the whole point, is because, like, he's literally transcended the need to exert himself.
Yeah.
And it's very... All the fight scenes are very blocked, I guess, is the word.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like, the part in the end where Trinity shoots somebody point blank in the head, and you do not see what you probably should see. that should be, like, really gory, and it's not. And then...
It's one perfect shot, honestly, because the camera goes out, and you see
it's a wide.
Like this, and it's so good.
Yes. I know, the cinematography in that movie is nutso. It's really, really good. But I think the goriest thing in the movie is the damn bug. The, like, robot bug. When that bug comes out of his stuff, like, that's, like, it's got, like, weird... like, pink matter on it. Like, that's the grossest thing and the goriest thing in the movie, weirdly.
It is kind of gross, actually.
I guess it's body horror, I guess, is the...
Yeah. Of course, when he loses his mouth, every time I watch that, I'm like, somehow I forgot about this again. And how disturbing it is again. And how effective it is. And what a nice metaphor it is. And just, it's a good scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great scene.
Yeah. Yeah, all the scene work in the movie is really, really good. Like, everything is like super well paced and like well constructed. I definitely will give it that for sure.
I think obviously it is a nerd fantasy, in a lot of ways. And the most obvious being that it feels like good virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
But like even beyond that, geeks love being told that, like, they know something that other people don't know,
but
they have information that other people don't have, and they are going to succeed because they're really, really good at the internet,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Intellectual superiority. And that it doesn't matter what your body is, your mind can do everything you need.
Your mind can do everything you need, and you also get to look however you want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, for Neo, that is pretty boring initially. The first time you see him with his residual, whatever they call it, the idea of you that lives in your mind, mm-hmm. he's just like wearing some jeans. His hair's a little bit longer because apparently he didn't like having a buzz cut. But then, of course, later, I mean, he looks like the 1999 version of a badass.
Yes.
Which is fair because it's a look that ages pretty well. You know, yeah. That's classic.
Yeah, Keanu wears it well.
But yeah, the idea that your brain is all you need is the ultimate nerd fantasy, right?
Yes, it really is.
And of course, I mean, 10 Things is also a nerd fantasy.
Yes, it is. I was thinking that
two
also.
Nerds getting exactly what they want. Mm-hmm. Or rather, no, actually, yeah, we can say that because Michael Eichmann also gets to date an interesting girl. Mm-hmm. In the form of Mandela. Mm-hmm. Oh, Mandela. And, certainly they succeed by being smarter than Joey Donner and by manipulating him the way that the machines manipulate humans, right?
Mm. Do you think that nerd fantasy fulfillment, nerd wish fulfillment, do you think there's a certain time that it rose into popularity culturally? And do you think that we are moving out of it? Are we still in it? Because I feel like there are answers to those questions. I feel like it maybe came to prominence at a certain point, and eventually we might move out of it. Or is it just our current definition of an underdog? And underdog stories are always told.
I think you see this a lot. In online rhetoric still within what have historically been bastions of geekdom, like comic books and Star Wars and Dungeons and Dragons. But the problem is that none of that is nerdy anymore. It's very normal.
Yeah.
And the internet is the great equalizer in that it allows people to find their, you know, their tribe or whatever, and make you realize that you're not alone, that there are lots of people who like this thing that you like, for better or worse. And, yeah, so anybody who uses that as a bludgeon of, like, oh, I was uncool when I was a teenager, and that's why XYZ thing needs to happen. I'm like, all right, but, I mean, that's not really the case anymore. Nobody is really getting made fun of for liking D&D and tabletop gaming. Instead, it's become a huge social thing that lots of people do, mm-hmm. like lots and lots and lots of people.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of people love Star Wars, and of course that's what has spun into the unending conversation of has my Star Wars been ruined by the new Star Wars?
I roll. That was an eye roll. You can't hear it, but
and
it
so,
happened.
Even if at the time in 1999 there was a need for this particular wish fulfillment, the need for human wish fulfillment is never going to go away.
True.
But I think that there are no longer very many underdog stories of that type. Like, you can't credibly make them anymore because those people are no longer underdogs. Like, the geeks have won.
Who are the underdogs now?
It's a good question.
I'm curious.
I mean, I guess the window shifts to whatever voice is marginalized at that time by the dominant monoculture, and it just happens to no longer be nerds, because superhero movies make boatloads of money. They're everywhere. There's a superhero for everybody. Star Wars is still making tons of movies. There are the Critical Role Kickstarter thing millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's nutso.
Like, yeah, those are no longer the put upon.
Maybe there's no such thing as a monoculture anymore. In terms of, like you said, having the internet being a great equalizer, maybe there's no such thing as a monoculture. Or the internet is the monoculture and everything is on the internet.
I would say the internet is the monoculture.
Fascinating. I'm like going down this rabbit hole in my brain. And this is part of why we wanted to discuss, like, The Matrix and 10 Things I Hate About You, because they were both iconic parts of pop culture at the time. 10 Things I Hate About You, maybe a little bit less so. Like, there are things that I quote from that movie, but that, you know, are probably just things that I quote from that movie that didn't necessarily make it into the mainstream. But watching The Matrix, like, my God, the phrase, there's a glitch in The Matrix, the red pill or the blue pill, like, the way that Hugo Weaving says, Mr. Anderson, like, the way
I'm sure everybody points this out always, and it happened at the time this film came out, and it has happened since, but he is so good.
He is really, really good. And then it just...
is just strange enough. Like,
yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah. The, like, combination of being completely mundane, but also completely, like, twisted at the same time. Like, he's so good. And then it made me laugh, because I was like, he's also in Lord of the Rings. Like, he's in, like, two, like, huge cultural touchstones for nerds around the same time. Like, but he's not super famous for it. It's not, like, I don't know. I wouldn't say that Hugo Weaving is, like, super well-known for, I don't know. Like, it's not like he skyrocketed to prominence because of either of those roles.
Right.
But anyways, but the thing where Keanu does the, like, the thing that Morpheus does with the hand, granted, some of this stuff was spoofed, like the special effects and the bullet scene and the backwards, like, fight sequence, like, those things were spoofed. The hand thing was spoofed. But certain other things were, I feel like, legitimately sort of, like, are now, like, like, cultural references to The Matrix. That didn't exist before The Matrix. So, yeah, it's such a... And I think I read, again, on the IMDb trivia, I think I read that, like, I think the Library of Congress put it, like, is, like, a noted work.
Yeah, it's a work of cultural significance, I'm pretty sure, to be preserved.
That's the thing. That's the name of it. But, like, deservedly so.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it certainly suffered... almost immediately, I think, because it was so widely well received, and because people couldn't shut up about it.
Mm-hmm. Overexposure.
And because there was so much material for internet communities to work with and talk about, and, like, symbolism, and, like, what would, you know, this
world
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it became its own parody very quickly.
Yeah.
The way that, of course, everything now does.
Yes.
Perhaps one of the first early memes. It's very mimetic. But even still, I mean, you know, you can watch it now and say, this is a good film. Like, it's well made.
Mm-hmm.
It holds up. Sure, a lot of it is sort of corny, or, like, overly philosophical in a pop way. But it all hangs together according to its internal logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it doesn't, like, grate on me in those ways.
No.
It's easy to suspend all the necessary parts and just, like, descend into that and experience what we thought virtual reality and AI were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, you know, set that against what they've become, because it is still very accurate in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Is this the AI portion of our conversation? Please continue.
Well, I like robots, and I'm polite to the robots that I encounter on the off chance that there is a robot uprising. Like, I don't want Alexa in my house, but when I encounter Alexa, I'm going to say please to her, just in case.
I say thank you when I use the talk to text feature, like if I'm driving and I need to text, like, my mom or something, like when she's like, I'll send it, and I'm always like, thank you. Although I do yell at her when she, just for no reason, like if I have directions on, and it's not, I guess it's Siri, but whatever. She's like, turn left, and inevitably the first thing out of my mouth is just, you turn left. That's so when the robot uprising comes, I'm screwed. Or at least they'll have a situation, they'll have pause to consider me a friend or foe based on my behavior.
Well, the thing I think is interesting about The Matrix is that the film kind of draws a line between the bad machines, who are the machines, capital M, who are controlling humanity's fate, who are harvesting humans for as a power source, which, you know, sensible.
I forgot about that. I forgot that's the reason why that whole backstory, when we got to it, I was like, man, this is dense. I forgot that there were, like, machines and that that's why they're, like, harvesting humans. I was like,
fields of humans.
Yeah, I did not remember that.
But it's sort of, like, it sets up that as, you know, the obvious evil, and then it sets up the world of the internet the way that Neo uses it as Thomas Anderson in what he thinks is reality, and the way that they use it as, like, training scenarios inside, you know, in terms of the Matrix itself, as if not good machines, then, like, neutral and, like, for the benefit of humanity, because we can use them, you know, against the bad machines.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about, like, our current time and how technology, how our relationship to technology is, I mean, you could definitely say that the internet is the bad machine, right?
Sure.
Because if you want to look at it as this machine is feeding on humans, like, that is pretty much the internet. The internet is basically Tom Riddle's diary, right, at this point. You put so much of yourself into it, and it manipulates that. It, you know, twists that. It uses every aspect of data that it can glean from you in order to try to control your life, right?
You raised good points.
I wish it wasn't this way.
Yeah. Well, we're not in control of that part of the internet. We're in control of the fun part of the internet, like message boards and memes and, like, stupid jokes on Twitter. Like, those are the good things. But that's the metaphor, though. Like, that we're using it for the good of humanity. But there are larger forces, like corporations and companies, and I don't know, big data, whatever. So.
The part in, I was reading something, one of the non-paywalled articles about 10 things that touched on Mandela's relationship to Shakespeare.
Interesting.
And the way that this writer couched that made it seem like they thought that this was really weird. And okay, maybe it's, like, slightly weird to say that you're involved with Shakespeare, but it's really not that weird. Like, it's really not.
Not, I mean, she's a Shakespeare stan. Like,
she's a Shakespeare stan. She's, like, maybe one of the first stans. And, of course, the way that fan culture developed because of the internet makes this seem very normal to me. Especially kind of. when you think about things like any number of fandom scandals, actually. But specifically the one where the guy was, like, a cult leader and he convinced people. It was something to do with Lord of the Rings fandom.
Oh, no.
And
oh, no.
And the guy was, like, a cult leader, and he convinced people that, like, he was some kind of a higher being.
Aww.
And so, yeah, in hindsight, Mandela having a deep personal relationship with Shakespeare is not strange at all. And in the context of fans online and personas online and all that kind of thing, like, it is honestly kind of prescient.
Mm-hmm.
So you do you, Mandela. Just don't fall in with any cult leaders.
Exactly.
Or claiming to be reincarnated Shakespeare.
I'd like to think that her apparent loose friendship with Kat would prevent her from going down that road. I feel like Kat would put the kibosh on any cult inklings that Mandela might entertain.
Well, because, I mean, her quip is like, oh, you progressed to full-on delusions or something,
yeah.
After when they're at the prom and Mandela's in her dress, and she's like, he said he'd meet me here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't tell if you did actually think that this was going to be Shakespeare. Are you going to be disappointed when it's just Michael Eichmann wearing, like, a ruff?
Well, that's the thing also. Like, they kind of, like, cosplay to prom. Like,
yeah,
that's not
it's
weird
very,
either.
Very early nerd. And, you know, of course, like, role-playing online is shades of this.
Mm-hmm.
Display obviously is a huge part of nerd culture now, and was probably then too, because, like, Renaissance fairs are sort of the precursor to that, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of people that I think of by their screen name, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I know their real names.
Yeah. Identity in the internet age is definitely, like, a huge thing. And I think, like, I don't know, you could also, the thing about 10 things where Kat sort of says, like, you don't have to be what they want you to be or what they expect you to be. And there's a lot of talk about, like, external expectation of, like, what you should and shouldn't be and do and, like, what the norms are. And like you said, with the internet, the norms are multiplying and there's not necessarily one norm anymore. Whereas, like, 1999, like, a lot of teen movies are still operating on that social hierarchy, I guess, of, like, the one norm being, like, jocks. Although, Joey Donner, is he a jock? He's not. We don't see him play a sport.
No, you see him wearing, like, a tank top at one point when he first propositions Patrick to his plan.
Mm.
But it definitely does not look like he's been exerting himself.
Really doesn't. The only athlete in the movie is
not a jock. He's just a rich boy. Like,
yeah, money. I guess money is really the currency that we're using.
And even in, like, a film like She's All That, which is, of course, in the grand tradition of classic works adapted for teen film, is My Fair Lady / Pygmalion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cat doesn't have a makeover sequence.
No, thank God. She would reject
she
that so much.
She gets
much.
To be herself in her very 90s girl wardrobe
I
throughout. And, yeah, she doesn't have that kind of girl trajectory that you would see in other teen films, necessarily.
Well, it doesn't Bianca say to her at some point, like, something along the lines of, like, you could be really pretty if you did XYZ? Like, isn't there some, that scene where they're in the bathroom, and then it gets derailed?
Yeah, she lifts her hair and says something about hostility.
Yeah.
You're like, it's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. I love Kat Stafford so much. I know it would be remiss of me to wax on about Bianca without, like, explaining that, like, Kat Stafford is, like, well and truly the center of my soul, and I love her so much. I love how cranky she is. I love how cantankerous she is and, like, kind of volatile and eye-rolly. And, like, this came out at, like, the great time of Julia Stiles where, like, she, between, it was, like, this, Save the Last Dance, and that was, like, the trifecta of, like, Julia Stiles just sort of, like, strutting on the teen scene and being like, yes, everyone wants to be me. You're welcome.
And, of course, I mean, the whole function of The Matrix is that Neo gets to choose who he wants to be.
Yes, that's where I was kind of sort of trying to go before I got distracted by my love of Kat Stafford.
You know, because, like, in his getting fired scene, his boss is like, you know, this is how it is. You're a cog in this company's wheel.
Mm.
You're not an individual. And so, you have a choice to make.
Yeah.
You can either not be an individual and have a job, or you can be an individual and be unemployed.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, when you put it that way.
Yeah.
And he's the only character who has two names, right?
I think so.
He's Thomas Anderson, and then he's Neo, and the whole time, like, start to finish, even before he enters the Matrix, or exits the Matrix, it's implied that Neo is who he really is.
Yeah.
And that's all anybody on the good side calls him. You don't ever find out what Trinity, you know, who Trinity was before she woke up.
Yeah.
And the, you know, Agent Smith tries to get at him by calling him Mr. Anderson, like, consistently.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a big deal when he says, my name's Neo, at the end, and he claims that that has to be extrapolated into, and I'm the savior, and I'm gonna beat you into the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, the embracing, and that's something, for as tiring as Chosen One narratives can be, and as tiring as prophecies can be as a narrative device, I do like about The Matrix that it's communicated to Neo that, like, he will only be the one when he believes he is the one. And then she tells him, you're not the one. Like, and so
Oracle is a huge troll.
I love her. But she is a huge troll. Troll with cookies. Yeah, the idea that, like, that he only really, the only way he does what he does is because he doesn't believe he's the one, and then he is able to sort of get to the point where he can believe he's the one, and then, like, access all of the higher levels of fight fighting. I don't know. You know what I mean? That, like, after he comes back to life, basically, after Trinity tells him, you can't die because the Oracle told me that I would be in love with the One, and I'm in love with you, so therefore you must be the One, and you can't die. That's when he's like, oh, like, okay. And then is, like, at the peak of his, like, oneness. But at the same time, like, he does all of the things to get to that point because he believes he's not the One, and therefore is just like, I'm gonna do whatever. Like, I'm gonna save Morpheus because, like, I'm supposed to and I want to and I'm not the One and I don't care.
Yeah. It reminds me of, you know, the end of Angel, the series.
Mm.
And, you know, if nothing we do matters, then all that matters is what we do.
Yeah.
Which is everyone's fave.
Yeah.
For good reason.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yeah, fate stories, you have to try really hard to make that interesting because fate is an inherently boring concept.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe in fate, I feel like you have license to be an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can really tell you not to. Or you can do the more interesting thing and say, well, if this isn't fated, then, like, what do I do? How do I act?
Yeah.
What choices do I make?
Yeah. I will forever be a little bit begrudging about J.K. Rowling writing in the fact that Neville could have also been the Chosen One, but then not really, like, going anywhere with that. The way... This is not a channel for Harry Potter complaints, but...
We're always open for Harry Potter.
Give me 30 seconds. I, as much as people do not care for Order of the Phoenix as a book, I can see some of the reasons why, but I feel like regardless of that, Order of the Phoenix set up a very strong structure for what the rest of the series was going to be or seemed to be, like, where it seemed to be headed based on, like, the entire set piece of the end of Order of the Phoenix, where the six of them go into the ministry and you find out about the prophecy, et cetera, yada, yada. And then she wrote the sixth book, and then it, like, wasn't a fulfillment of that. Like, she was just like, meh, it's like Snape time, y'all. And also we have to explain, like, this whole book is a setup for what the rest of the series is going to be. And I was a little bit like, but you already did that at the end of the fifth book and without Snape, about whom I do not care as much as you think I do. So, sorry. I mean, like, Snape is interesting, yes, but I will always be more
Snape
interested.
Snape wives. That's what I was going to talk about with Mandela, Snape wives.
Mm.
That's the direct analogy is Snape wives. If you guys want to Google Snape wives, although you probably know what I mean.
I don't think I want to Google Snape wives.
No, but you're right, because, like, the whole interesting thing about Neville is that, you know, the idea that that a great villain can create their own adversary by a choice,
mm-hmm.
right? And mm-hmm. he could have chosen Neville, instead he chose Harry.
Mm-hmm.
For personal reasons. And in The Matrix, it's like, it's not really a case of the adversary creating their opponent. It's more of a case of the heroes creating their savior, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Morpheus. Like, Morpheus believes.
Like, he's the only one super invested in this.
Yeah.
The machines don't care.
Yeah.
Like, Agent Smith would have been this way to anybody who came up against him.
Yeah.
Because all he wants to do is leave. Which is kind of relatable, honestly.
That was also interesting. I liked that was, like, an extra dimension for the villain, that, like...
He's just really sick of his job.
Yeah, like, humanized him in a weird way, despite the fact that he is not human, but, like, that he wanted something beyond the destruction of his enemy. Basically, that the destruction of his enemy was the thing that would get him what he wanted. It wasn't the end game, but, like, the means to what he wanted was to go take a nap.
Like, he had a really good reason for once for, one, like, needing to destroy the hero. Because usually it's, like, you know, in the case of another superhero film, the important thing is the foe.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's, like, it could have been Trinity in this case. And Agent Smith still would have wanted to shuffle the mortal coil and get away from how bad humans smell or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with Neo. It's not personal. It's
yeah.
just business.
Well, yeah, exactly. Which is another an element of, like, the whole individual versus the entity thing of like the I don't want to say the banality of evil because that means something different with a different context, but the idea of like the mundane being evil in sort of a modern society, like basically once we got the concept of an office, then all of a sudden, like starting from the 50s onwards, like that has been like a theme of like the evil of being the same or the evil of losing your identity and becoming just one part of a group. And I feel as well, like, I feel like in the US, we've always leaned more towards the Greeks than the Hebrews. Like we've always been individualistic to a fault, but in the past you couldn't feasibly do that because community was how you survived. And we've gotten enough technology at this point for Americans to really amass the idea that like the individual is always preferable to the group, to the collective, that you lose your identity when you become a part of a group and that is inherently bad. And it's interesting to see where that's going to go, how that's going to serve us long term, because it's not going great, guys.
No, it's not. And it's interesting to think about that with Cypher, because like he really resents having woken up. Like he actively regrets having taken the pill that he chose.
Yeah.
And he wants to be reinserted back into the Matrix and not remember anything, most specifically.
Yeah.
And so like he's rejecting the collective that he's become part of by choice, and he wants the collective that he was a part of by no choice of his own.
Yeah.
Which, on the one hand, I get it. You're tired, buddy.
Yeah. Both
just like Agent Smith.
Exactly. Both the villains just want to take a nap. They just want out. They do not have the energy. Which is great that, like, there's no evil plan. They're not trying to destroy the world. They are just tired.
Yeah. It's interesting to... I wouldn't say that they're ineffective, obviously. I mean, Cypher is a perfectly serviceable lower league villain.
Sure.
And Agent Smith is a very effective, you know, top tier villain.
Sure.
Like, he's the final boss.
A
and
big
he's
bad.
Scary. But, you know, you never get the sense that that's actually the end game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, neither of them, watching it now, it's like, they're not really evil. They're not the seat of evil.
Mm-hmm. Who is the Emperor Palpatine here? That's the real question.
Snoke. Somewhere.
Oh, no.
Somewhere behind the scenes.
Well, and that's the thing that makes it more interesting, because normally there is a big bad who has a big plan and, like, needs to remove the, like, which I guess the big bad, the big bad is the machines, really, and the agent is an agent that's enforcing the system of oppression.
Yeah, it's difficult now to remember what I thought about the villain structure at the time when I was watching this when I was a teenager, because
sure.
I wasn't thinking about that at all.
Understandable.
I was thinking about how cool Trinity was.
Fair.
And how much I wanted a trench coat and would never have been allowed to buy one. But yeah, but now it's like it's so diffuse because our relationship to technology is much different than, and also exactly the same as what the Matrix thought it would be.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting. It's an interesting villain structure, and it makes me think, again, not having seen the next two, if they went larger in scope with the villain structure in the next two, because it seems like there's an opportunity there.
I was going to say something about Joey Donner, but I can't remember what it was.
As the villain structure?
Like, there's not really a villain in that film either. I mean, Joey's an asshole and he's a dick to Kat, but he's not really a threat to her.
No.
She totally disregards him. She thinks he's annoying. The only reason that she cares about him at all is in the context of Bianca. And even then, Bianca gets herself out of her own situation by realizing that Joey's a dick.
Yes. That's true, because he's definitely a threat to Bianca, because there's some, like, gross, like...
Yeah, it's because she's, like, what, 15,
yeah.
I think?
Yeah.
And he's probably 18.
Yeah, there's some, yeah. And, like, the whole, like, virgin alert thing, like, there's some real gross. He's definitely a villain to Bianca, which is why it's, like, I don't want to say, which is why it's great that Kat cares, but obviously, like, she does care, and we care as the audience. But yeah, but when she realizes that Joey's a dick, like, Bogie Lowenstein's party is, like...
It's fairly early in the film.
Yeah, it's not... I wouldn't say it's any more than halfway, because it's also the inciting incident for Kat to actually like, or to show her cards that she does like Patrick, because she's drunk. So that's, you know, that's not later. And certainly, like, Bianca realizing that Joey's a dick is certainly not the culmination of her arc. She kind of...
Yeah, it keeps going.
So, yeah, so it does kind of question, like, well, once you deflate the tension of Joey Donner as a villain as, like, a threat to Bianca, then, like, where does that tension go after that? Is it just the tension of... Is the villain is just the scheme and the threat to, like, Kat?
Yeah,
happiness?
I mean, if you keep... I feel like the through line is that if Cameron and Michael are the machines in this scenario, then they are, by dint of that, they are the villains. It's a fairly villainous thing to do to somebody.
It is. Well, and because, like, they're puppeting Joey. They're doing what Joey is doing. They're doing the exact same thing. They just don't have money. And Joey's the one who has the money. So it's... Yeah, they're part of the same scheme. And Patrick is doing it also. All of the schemers are men.
Go figure.
Yeah. But yeah, but like, I guess Joey, I don't remember how much we see of Joey after Bogie Lowenstein's party, but he does think that he's bringing Bianca to prom. He shows up on her doorstep.
It's funny because, like, that's super realistic, I feel like.
Yes.
For somebody to, you know, especially, you know, for a guy to not take the hint.
Yeah.
Because the next time we see him, I think, is when Bianca's doing archery. He has a really good line. He says, hey, you're concentrating awfully hard considering it's gym class. And I'm like, yeah, true, bro.
Yeah. And doesn't, he calls
still
her, like,
an asshole, but true.
And he calls her Cupid, too, also,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, gross.
And he says something in that scene that makes it very clear that he's not having a conversation, and he's just, like, he's giving her information that he assumes she wants,
yeah,
which is that this is what's going to happen for the prom.
Yeah.
And then he shows up at her house wearing a tux, and her dad is like, we're not having any of this, and just closes the door, because obviously Bianca's already left for the prom with Cameron.
Yes.
And so, well, Joey's, like, totally out of the loop in multiple ways the entire time.
He was going for thoughtful.
And it does strike me as very on point for, like, that type of male character to just be like, oh, of course she wants my attention, and of course she's going to agree to this because she is, you know, she's Neo in the cubicle. She doesn't have a mouth.
Yeah. Well, that, yeah, like, she shows disinterest towards him in the archery scene. She does not say much, and what she says is, like, not enthusiastic at all. But he's not...
I think she literally says, like, what do you want?
Yeah. I love her. Yeah, so, like, he's clearly not, and that's the whole point, is that he's clearly not interested in anything she has to say, that she is, like, a conquest. Which makes you wonder, I mean, the backstories in 10 Things I Hate About You are interesting, because they're there, but they're not super fleshed out. Number one being the fact that their mom left, which is interesting, because that's not a common, usually if a parent leaves, it's the dad in movies. And then the second thing being Kat's backstory with Joey, that, like, she slept with Joey in ninth grade. And, like, they're the same age, so it's sort of, I don't know, it's interesting to sort of think about, like, what that was like. Like, the film doesn't give us a lot of other information about either backstory. They're both good backstories to help add meaning to, like, the current, you know, narrative that we get, but they don't give us more, and I'm curious. I have questions.
Yeah, and honestly, nobody gets any backstory in The Matrix. Like, it literally does not exist.
That's
Trinity,
like,
doesn't exist prior to the film.
Yeah, I want
even
the Trinity.
Neo doesn't really exist. I mean, all we know about Thomas Anderson is that he is a software wonk, because of course he is. And that he has some sort of a hacker persona that he makes money off of by... I'm not really sure what he's selling that guy. I can't think what that would have been at the time. Some kind of, like, souped-up software?
Not
or
a clue.
A virus, maybe?
Not a clue.
Who knows? It was on a tiny, tiny microdisc.
Yeah, not, I have no idea what that would have been.
But, you know, like, that's all.
Yeah.
And we have no idea who these people were before they woke up. We don't yet have the information about Zion, so that, you know, to give context to Tank and Dozer being, like, born there. And born, like, free, air quote.
Yeah. I love Tank.
Oh. Yes.
Oh, Tank. I love him. He's so excited.
It has hurt me from the time that I first saw this film to the present day, how little APOC there is.
Yeah.
He dies way too fast.
He really does. All of the whole crew.
Yeah, but APOC is the hottest.
Okay.
That's the source of my sorrow.
Another thing I read on IMDb was that Switch was originally called that because the character was going to be portrayed by the actress in The Matrix, but by a male actor in reality, and that there was like an androgyny or like sort of like a trans metaphor.
Switch is very androgynous.
True.
I don't think it's ever, I feel like it's implied that that's a female character because of like some costuming choices.
Sure.
But I mean, no, you know, the Wachowskis in the present day, like there's just shitloads of gender stuff in The Matrix.
Yes. Well, even like, it's interesting kind of looking at both films, you know, sort of, we talked about like, you know, the girl power, like women in the film, but I think also like, in terms of, like, queer coding or, like, queer lenses or, like, LGBT lenses, it's interesting because both of them are also coming out at a time where, like, we're starting to get the ball moving on that in cinema and in media a little bit better. And ironically, it's the internet that keeps pushing that forward, and that pushes that forward in, like, a huge way. Like, both move, like, I feel like that, like, the character of Switch made me think of that. And then, and also the in The Matrix, the concept of, like, to a lesser extent, in 10 Things I Hate About You, like, who does society want you to be? What's your name in the real world? But, like, who are you really? Like, who do you really feel that you are? And, like, the idea that, like, other people can label you things or identify you with certain things, but that you identify, like, this, you have the power to identify your own self. Which is in both films, but probably stronger in The Matrix because of sci-fi.
Sci-fi, and yeah, I mean, in hindsight, it does seem very intentional that they would have been making those types of metaphors. Of course, the going back to, you know, Trinity and not a guy. Mm. You might think I coded the guy in my hacker spaces because that's what men want to see, and this is who I really am. We don't know who she was prior to this, so
give us the backstory.
I mean, it was probably established in some, like, video game, maybe, or there's probably more information given in the second and third films that I'm just forgetting, because lots of that has been lost.
That's
my memory.
It doesn't seem like it was useful. We'll just go to the Matrix wiki. We'll go there.
And, yeah, the waking up sequence after Neo has made his choice is, like, really disturbing and weird and jarring. And, I mean, the whole point of it, I'm pretty sure, is that, you know, human babies don't remember being born.
Mm.
And it's, like, a good thing because it's very violent and probably painful. And that he gets to experience this because he's an adult.
Yeah.
And after that, he's literally someone new. Like, he's who he was supposed to be all along.
Mm. Yeah, a rebirth.
Which it feels like, a lot of the times, I think, in the real world, is a violent act, even if it's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
It's that act of becoming.
Mm. Well, it upends everything. And, I mean, if you're in terms of, like, coming out, like, it shifts your reality and it shifts your place in it, and that, like, it will always be, like, an upheaval of some kind, in good and bad ways. Have we covered it all? All of it. We got all of it. We got everything that you could possibly say about The Matrix and 10 Things I Hate About You in one sitting.
I don't know. We didn't talk about the soundtracks.
Oh. They're both, I mean, I hold the 10 Things I Hate About You soundtrack near and dear. even though I'm not really up on, like, Gen X music taste. That's what I refer to. Well, Gen X music taste.
Yeah, because, I mean, it. I think it's a great soundtrack, but you cannot deny the fact that it has a Sister Hazel song on it.
And a Bare Naked Ladies song on it.
And a Bare Naked Ladies song.
Although it's meant to poke, it's meant to be a little bit, because by contrasting, I Don't Give a Damn About My Reputation, like, by contrasting Cat Stafford with the, like, teeny boppy girls and the convertible, like, it's meant to sort of poke fun at Bare Naked Ladies, but still, that soundtrack is full of 90s goodness.
Yeah, they really are kind of, like, mirror worlds of each other, because the Matrix soundtrack is also extremely late 90s, but it's just totally, totally, I mean, because it has, what, Rob Zombie on it, and Rage Against the Machine, and some real interesting chorals.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what song is over the credits, but I was like, oh, turn it down. Like, I'm an old lady when it comes to that. Like, I can't. I was like, this is giving me a headache. This is so discordant. It, like, unsettles me at my very core.
I really liked watching both of them on the same night for a lot of reasons, but also because they both still feel like insane wish fulfillment, specifically through the musical lens, because music is important to me.
Okay.
And sure, when I was that age, when I was a teenager and I was seeing these movies for the first time, like, I would have loved to have lived in Seattle in the 90s and been, like, that kind of girl.
Yeah.
But I was about to be the kind of person who wanted to wear trench coats and listen to heavy metal. And I couldn't do either of those things. And, you know, the moral of that story is that, no, you can't be punk if you aren't willing to be punk. So,
I was never going to be that
type of a teenager.
No.
But I wanted to be. I wanted to be both of these things. And I think that they fit together really nicely in that way of being, like, on the one hand, like, cool riot girl wish fulfillment, and on the other hand, like, cool cyberpunk girl wish fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, like we talked about the girl power thing, like, for young women watching movies, you know, at any time, but in this time in particular, is sort of, like, female characters were starting to come into their own, and it was starting to be a more common thing that, like, you know, yes, dudes watching The Matrix, that Neo is, like a very self-indulgent fantasy kind of thing. But, like, watching, like, for a, like, a teenage girl watching either of those movies, like, Kat and Trinity are, like, kind of the coolest possible people you could, like, ever hope to be. Like, they're absolutely, like, in, like, a pantheon of female characters.
Yeah, I mean, most women my age love one thing, and that is competency.
Yeah.
Everyone loves Dana Scully because she's really good at her job.
Yeah,
it's
true.
She's just insanely good at her job. And Kat's the same way. Teen, you know, the teen version of this is having an opinion and being bold enough to speak it, right? Or say, you know, the line about Hemingway that I still use because it's true.
I love her.
And, yeah, so it's natural to graduate from Kat in English class to Trinity being, like, this insane hacker who's better than all the guys, and who also gets to wear latex and kick ass.
Yeah. Yeah, and you get the idea that, like, if Kat went to the movies and saw The Matrix, the Kat would, like, be all about Trinity.
Like, yes.
Absolutely.
If The Matrix existed in the Ten Things universe, like, she and Mandela would go, and they would probably start wearing a lot of eyeliner after
Yes,
that.
Exactly.
Although, notably, Carrie Ann Moss doesn't wear eyeliner.
She has
a very natural makeup look, actually.
Maybe she's born with it. That's what I was going for. I was like, she's got the look? No,
that's
not it.
Because you gotta figure, if you can look like anything, then you would do, you know, a fairly bold eye, I feel like, but... Mm.
This is neither here nor there, but, well, so, one, the Matrix references both Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland. Both of those things were heavy in the mythology of Lost also. And even though Lost is not, I wouldn't put, like, a direct line between the Matrix and Lost, but there's a line there. You could, like, Damon Lindelof and J.J. Abrams, like, you could tell definitely
they were taking notes.
Yes, exactly. So Lost was, like, already on the brain in terms of... And Lost also has the whole, like, mythology meets sci-fi thing, and then, like, struggled with merging those two things. But, like, when it was good, it did that very well. But all of this sounds smart, considering that what I'm about to say is that, honestly, Carrie Ann Moss in The Face reminds me a lot of Elizabeth Mitchell, and I didn't really, like, realize that before.
They have a very similar repose, I think.
They do. And what's
because
silly...
usually Trinity's face is, like, very calm and unemotional. And, yeah, I can definitely see, especially around her eyes and, like, the way that her cheekbones rest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, I think because I didn't watch The Matrix a lot after initially watching it, you know, a lot. And then also, I haven't watched much that Carrie Ann Moss has been in since then, so her face has always been a little bit fuzzy to me in my memory. I'm always just like, short black hair, bold lip, dark eyes. That's Carrie Ann Moss. Like, I don't know. And so then watching it as an adult and being like, what do you actually look like, Carrie Ann Moss? And I'm like, oh, you actually kind of remind me of Elizabeth Mitchell. That's my not astute observation.
I have to figure, considering that the costuming is obviously very intentional, that, like, she and Neo are supposed to look very similar. Because Keanu Reeves is a very beautiful man.
It's true.
And he specifically is beautiful and not handsome,
yeah.
I would say. Like, he's, I mean, obviously now the joke is that he's ageless.
True.
but at the time, you know, he's in the to cross back to 10 things, he's a pretty guy.
He's a pretty guy. Kat would love him.
And
no, way better choice than Jared Leto.
That one didn't age well.
That one did not age well. Unlike Keanu Reeves, that one did not age well.
No, but yeah, he and Trinity have a very similar look.
They really do.
Which, yeah, I mean, you have to figure that's intentional, and they're supposed to be each other's, like, half, I suppose, you know, the idea of some sort of androgynous super being.
Yeah, and also just maybe why they're attracted to each other.
That too, they might just both be very vain. it's funny to think about the 90s hottie.
Because
Keanu Reeves by this point was very well established as a 90s hottie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'd already been in Point Break.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Speed, I think, put him on the map as the 90s hottie, and that was, like, what, 93? 94? Mm-hmm.
Whereas Heath Ledger wasn't there yet.
Mm-mm.
I feel like he had been in The Patriot prior to this,
yeah.
And that was probably his first huge film, because that came out when we were in middle school,
yeah.
Right? Because I remember seeing, like, a book about the movie in Barnes & Noble and being like, that boy is very pretty.
With
his long blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't Heath Ledger yet.
No.
He wasn't, you know, that. For a female audience, or for an audience that is attracted to men, like, those two movies sort of fit together well in that sense of, like, this is the teen movie with a young man star who is not established yet, and then this is the adult movie with a male star who is about to be a superstar.
Well, and it also kind of, yeah, the idea that the leading male roles are kind of, they seem like they were cast in the female gaze.
Yeah, because even when Neo has become badass Neo, like, he's still kind of cuddly and a little bit doofy.
Yeah.
And the whole way through, he's rather incompetent, and he says corny things like, you know, I know Kung Fu. Like, yes, buddy, you do. That's the whole point. You know everything now. Like, there's nothing you don't know.
Well, even, like, when he... So, like, when he's Thomas Anderson, like, when he's at work, he's in a brown suit, right? I think.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's
maybe
difficult
not
to tell, because all of the real, air quote, real world lighting, it has that green matrix tint, and so it's like, what am
yeah.
I actually looking at?
That
I don't
is
know
true.
What color this is supposed to be.
That is true. But in the end, like...
But he's not black.
Yes, and when he does wear all black, his coat is, like, a wool texture. He doesn't, like, Trinity has the, like, slick leather-looking,
yeah.
Like, shiny coat, but his is, like, I'm a cuddly coat. Like, it's, like, wool. And he's wearing, like, a sweater, even. He's, like, a sweater boy.
He is. He's a sweater boy. He's in multiple sweaters in this film,
oh my
which
God.
Is insane in hindsight, like, what they were, how specifically they were tailoring this to my interests.
I know. I love a sweater boy.
He wears, like, waffle knit constantly, which is the best knit.
It is the best knit. Oh, God. Damn it, Wachowskis.
And Patrick, like, he's supposed to, you know, he's very, like, grunge boy looking. He's got long hair that's not particularly well kept. He doesn't ever put much, you know, set against Joey. Joey's super manicured. His hair is slicked back. He's, like, perfectly tan. He, you know, has his 1,000-watt grin. He's, like, the cute one. And Patrick is like, well, you know, it's believable that he did a year in San Quentin.
The shirt, it's not a sweater, but the shirt that Patrick wears in the final scene that's, like, that long sleeve t-shirt with the stripes is, like, Dreamboat, like, ideal costuming. Like,
yeah, they're both very kind of soft, enlightened, proto-Oscar Isaac heroes.
Yeah.
If the internet had been the internet at the time these films came out, they would have been the internet's boyfriends.
Yeah.
And obviously Keanu Reeves is the internet's boyfriend still.
It's true.
Slash possibly the internet's dad in some cases. Because, as we know, he's without age.
It's true. He is eternal.
But yeah, they're definitely in that safe, like, you're allowed to, like, lust after this character and it's not going to turn on you mode.
Yeah. Yeah. God bless.
I always appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you think about what the male nerd wish fulfillment is supposed to be, or what maybe, like, the dominant narrative is supposed to be, is that, oh, these guys who are awkward or intellectual or not stereotypically attractive want to be some kind of an alpha, which may or may not be true. And in the case of Neo, like, you could say that he becomes an alpha male, but he doesn't sacrifice anything in terms of personality to get there.
Mm-mm.
And in effect, it's him becoming worthy of Trinity, because it's Trinity's prophecy that, like, the Oracle doesn't say anything to him about love.
Yeah.
All she tells him is that he's not the one.
Yeah.
And in order for Trinity to love him, he has to be the one. It's sort of, like, recursive, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, by the end, when he's literally covered in guns and all these American phallic symbols of violence, he's still wearing a sweater.
Yeah.
And he and Trinity are sharing this fight scene, and he is still this, like, sort of, like, awkward weirdo.
And he's going to save his mentor, and, like, he's going to save the person who believes in him more than anyone, and, like, it's darling, frankly. Like,
it's pretty darling.
It is pretty darling. Swoon.
The Matrix, a great feel-good film.
Yeah, somehow that's not on the DVD cover.
And, yeah, I mean, Patrick is the same way. He's supposed to, you know, the boys in the film think that he's scary and, like, a badass, and he hangs out in bars, and he sold his liver, and he ate a live duck.
Yeah.
And all these weird, totally outrageous things that somehow get parroted, like, credulously by these boys.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Bianca has no idea who this is.
Yeah.
And Kat, when she meets him, is like, she literally leaves the conversation, which is probably the first time that I realized you could do that. You didn't have to just let a guy talk to you, you could just walk away. She walks off the screen.
She's a hero. Well, and he says, you're like, you're not scared of me, are you? And she says, like, why should I be?
Like, he obviously thinks that these things that people say about him are funny, and most of them have something else going on, you know, that is the real truth and the more boring truth. And even, like, in terms of visual coding, he's not even really that scary looking.
Mm.
He just wears jeans.
Yeah.
And his hair's kind of long. Like, he's in the mode of, you know, Christian Slater and Heathers, except not evil. Because as much as I don't like Christian Slater, and as much as JD is evil, like, yeah, he still has the look. It would appeal to, you know, a Kat or Veronica-type girl.
I do wish that we... Bianca never comments on Patrick, does she? Do we ever get another female opinion on Patrick other than Kat and Miss Perky?
No, because, like, once they're a thing, I feel like Mandela even doesn't really talk about it. And she sort of, you know, she's not quite as involved. She's too busy being involved with Shakespeare.
Exactly.
And the only time that Bianca interacts with him is when she's wearing the belly. And even then, she doesn't say anything. She just glares at him. Because he says, you know, who knocked up your sister? Oh, my God.
I love that film so much.
So, yeah, there's no opinion on Patrick's male beauty from any of the other female characters.
Hmm. Well, and that's, like, and then part of it is in parallel, because part of the thing about, and that's in the movie, like, who can they get that can go toe-to-toe with Kat, and it's this guy, that, like, she also, people are scared of her, and there are rumors about her, that, like, and that they do that in the end, after their paintball fight, they compare, like, what has been said about them and what's true or not, and almost all of his are false.
Yeah.
And not all of hers are. Bobby Ridgway's groin was true. In the beginning when she says something about, when Miss Perky says, like, something about Bobby Ridgway, and then, like, by the way, his testicle retrieval surgery really went well or something.
Allison Janney's a gem.
She is. She's so funny in this movie. She's so good.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that the reason, of course, that they choose Patrick is because they think, well, Kat's very scary, so we need somebody who's equally scary in order to kick this off and make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reason that they like each other isn't that they're both scary. Neither of them is scary.
Mm-hmm.
But they're both very in control of, like, their own narratives.
They're competent.
And, yeah, they're competent. Kat is going to fucking Sarah Lawrence, which is impressive.
Yeah.
And I don't know what Patrick is doing after graduation, but he's doing something.
He's going to go with her.
And he's honestly not that concerned. He's probably going to go with her. And that's, you know, that's romance, right? It's not like, it's finding somebody whose narrative intersects with yours.
Mm-hmm.
They work together well, not because they're equally terrifying, but because they both already know who they are.
Mm-hmm. And there's not a power imbalance in between them. Actually, yeah. And there's not a perceived one either. At least once they get past
this. Yeah, they're
never,
like, the only thing that Patrick is ever trying to convince Kat of is that he likes her.
Yeah.
Which is pretty funny if you think about it. she's not trying to convince him of anything other than disinterest. And then, you know, after she decides that she is interested, then, like, the only, you know, the... It's kind of funny how the tension of how they get together, like, subsides.
Mm-hmm.
And then you almost forget about it. And then you're like, oh, no.
Yeah.
She doesn't know this.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Did we cover it?
Probably.
Okay. 1 hour and, oh, God, we're almost at the 2 hour mark. No one. If you are still with us listening to all of this about... 10 Things I Hate About You in the Matrix, like, bless you and all your descendants, because this was such a weird, interesting, potentially not interesting, actually, like, topic or rabbit hole to go down to take two movies that just happened to be released on the same day 20 years ago and talk about them. So if you're still with us, we thank you. And who knows, maybe I'll trim out some of the last stuff. Maybe it won't exactly be 2 hours, but... Whatever, it's almost the length of each of the movies. So,
I still think they fit together perfectly.
I really like your metaphor about the Janus coin, about, like, 10 Things I Hate About You being the last film of the 20th century and The Matrix being the first of the 21st, because that's pretty cool and pretty accurate.
Thank you. Editor's note, I am not a film expert.
You still know what you're talking about, though. You still.
I'm like the character in Wayne's World when they go to the TV set, and Rob Lowe says, "Oh, do you work in TV?" And she says, "No, but I watch a lot of it."
That's how you learn. That's really all you need. So with that, the next time you hear from us, it will probably be back about Animorphs, as we talk about The Test. Until then, keep an eye out for any movies that were released on the same day, either in 1990s or otherwise, and maybe there's something interesting to be mined there. I'm surprised that you've never been told before.